Looking to unlock uncapped upside from largest and most recognized NASDAQ 100 names, bolstered by the potential income and diversification benefits of bonds? Look to ticker CANQ. The Calamos Alternative NASDAQ and Bond ETF. CANQ delivers options-based exposure to NASDAQ 100 stocks, combining the risk mitigation and income benefits of a fixed income foundation. Upside NASDAQ 100 potential, manageable downside risk, while seeing monthly income along the way. That's a ticker worth researching. Demand more from your NASDAQ equity allocation. Explore ticker CANQ, the Calamos Alternative NASDAQ and Bond ETF. To learn more about CANQ, visit calamos.com/CANQ. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Please see the prospectus and summary prospectus containing this and other information, which can be obtained by calling 1-866-363-9219. Read it carefully before investing. An investment in the fund is subject to risks, and you could lose money on your investment in the funds. There can be no assurance that the funds will achieve its investment objective. Your investment in the fund is not a deposit in a bank and is not insured or guaranteed by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or any other government agency. The risks associated with an investment in the fund can increase during times of significant market volatility. More detailed information regarding these risks can be found in the fund's prospectus. NASDAQ and NASDAQ 100 are registered trademarks of NASDAQ, Inc., distributed by Calamos Financial Services, LLC.
ETF Prime is hosted by Nate Geraci, president of investment advisory firm, The ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. Some guests appearing on this program may also be financial sponsors of ETF Prime. The ETF Store is not affiliated with VettaFi or any of its affiliates. VettaFi's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or indication by VettaFi of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, joining me will be Rob Harvey, co-head of product specialist at Dimensional, who has had quite the run over the past several years since entering the ETF space. They launched their first ETF in November of 2020. They're already up to $130 billion in assets, $130 billion. They're now the eighth largest ETF issuer. And they're actually within shouting distance of both sixth and seventh place on the ETF leaderboard. It would not surprise me at all to see Dimensional move up further this year. But it's pretty remarkable what they've accomplished in those 3.5 years. And so Rob and I are going to discuss that growth and why their approach is resonating with investors. And then we're actually going to spend the majority of our time on a topic that I find extremely interesting, which is comparing traditional indexing with Dimensional's approach, which they would describe as systematic active. And I find this interesting because in conversations I've had with investors and advisors, I would say most are pretty clear on the differences between traditional active management and systematic active. They understand traditional active is typically a manager trying to pick stocks that they think will outperform, and they view systematic active as being much more methodical, right? It's in the name, systematic. Dimensional actually says they're aiming to beat the market, not outguess it, which I think is the perfect description here. But I find that there is some confusion between systematic active and traditional indexing. Again, because of that systematic term. I think some investors and advisors aren't exactly clear on how that differs from a rules-based indexing approach. And so we're going to dive fairly deeply into this topic and get into the pros and cons of each approach and hopefully clear up any confusion. Should be a great conversation with Rob. Now, to start this week, I have Laura Krieger on the line with me. Laura is, of course, editor-in-chief at Vettafi. And with the first quarter now winding down, we thought it'd be fun to look at some of the more interesting ETF flow stories so far this year. As always, as you start parsing through the flow data, there are some ETFs that I think just jump out at you. And I would say nobody better at attempting to read the tea leaves here and trying to discern what's going on from an investor standpoint with these flows than Laura. So let's chat with her now.
Now we're joined by the experts at Vettafi, a new data analytics and thought leadership company that is transforming financial services from an industry to a community, one relationship at a time.
There's a couple of different ways to slice and dice these various ETFs. They can hold what are called total return swaps. Expect the unexpected.
Laura, great having you back on the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
All right. So I think you know I love going through ETF flows because I feel like there are always some obvious stories that jump out. Like I would say this year, clearly spot Bitcoin ETFs are a hot topic. And we will get to that later. I'm sorry. You know, we have to cover that. But there are also always some under the radar stories as well. And I feel like those are the ones that are really fun digging into. So I am looking forward to this. Now, I thought before we get to those, just at a high level, I'm curious if anything is standing out to you as you look at the flow data overall. So I show about $160 billion into ETF so far this year. And by the way, for listeners, as we go through some of this flow data, I think Laura and I might be using some different data sets, whether you look at FactSet or Bloomberg or whoever, sometimes there can be some noise. So if we have some differences here, just that's the reason why. But Laura, again, $160 billion or so into ETFs this year, I think that's pretty good. Any quick thoughts on flows overall?
Yeah, and I'll keep this brief because I know we want to get a little bit more into the weeds with a particular ETF here. But what I think is really pops right out at me is that we're seeing a lot of money go into U.S.-based securities, so equity and fixed income. About twice as much is going into equity ETFs as is going into bonds. So, bonds are still fairly popular. They're still very popular, but it definitely seems to me like this is, the risk on trade's back. Both are doing well, however, compared to, say, international securities or commodities. Commodities has lost a lot of money year to date, about $6 billion, mostly from gold ETFs. And I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that, too.
Yeah, and just real quick, because we will get a little more granular here. If you look at the top 10 ETF inflows, so this is as of this morning, to your point on U.S. equities, the top two on the leaderboard are VU and IVV, both S&P 500 ETFs. Then you have IBIT, the iShares Bitcoin ETF, and then VTI, right, the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index. So that's about $8 billion in flows. And you have FBTC, another spot Bitcoin ETF, DYNF, which is an iShares factor rotation strategy. You have the Qs. You have SPLG, so another S&P 500 ETF, and then VGIT, Intermediate Term Treasury Bond ETF. So I think that gives you a flavor. The other thing I'll note, too, that just I saw this morning, U.S. ETF assets overall aren't too far away from $9 trillion, which I thought was pretty interesting. It's amazing. And, of course, as you have more assets, it's easier to start hitting these milestones. But, you know, it's not out of the question. I don't think it's going to happen this year, but we could hit $10 trillion by the end of the year if you get a good market tailwind. In any event, let's dig into some specific ETF flow stories. And I thought I'll just open this up to you, and we can bat these around. And I will say, let's refrain from talking spot Bitcoin ETFs for the time being. As I mentioned, we will get to those later. Otherwise, I have a little problem, and so that might eat up too much of our time. So let's maybe start on the equity side. Give us some ETFs that have caught your attention this year.
Okay, so the one that caught my attention out of the list of when you were just rattling off all those funds, the one that just stopped me in my tracks was DYNF, right? This BlackRock U.S. Equity Factor Rotation ETF. It's bought in nearly $6 billion $6 billion year to date. It's the sixth or seventh highest flows getter of the year, depending on your numbers. And this is true even though it saw some pretty big outflows earlier in the week due to what I think is probably a tax-related trade, but the tape's going to show that later on. But DYNF is surprising to me, more so than Bitcoin ETFs or small caps or whatever, and because it seems so so specific and out there, right? Like, why is this random factor rotation ETF doing so well? And here's what I think is going on. It's model portfolios, right? It's getting these huge creates specifically because of model allocation activity, primarily from BlackRock shifting money around in its own portfolios, eating their own lunch, so to speak. This is an active multi-factor ETF that's designed to offer U.S. equity exposure, but better, and it's beating IVV by 170 basis points so far in the year. So, and also it's only 30 basis points, too, which is pretty good for active multi-factor exposure. So this is a great example of a ETF that's benefiting from what we've talked about in the past, that bring-your-own-assets trend. And I think we're going to see more of this phenomenon just continue to happen in the ETF space. And I know you said don't talk about Bitcoin ETFs, but I wouldn't be surprised to see if that's one of the reasons why iShares and Fidelity have seen such enormous growth in their Bitcoin ETFs, is because they're doing the same thing for those funds as they're doing with DYNF and allocating it within their own model portfolios.
Yeah, I think all of that is well said. This is an interesting ETF that does just jump out at you on that top 10 list. And if I recall correctly, maybe a month or so ago, I feel like Bloomberg had reported there was a move in BlackRock's model portfolios. If I remember correctly, they sold their quality factor ETF and maybe their S&P 500 one, or I'm sorry, their S&P 100 ETF. And then they moved into DYNF and I think a value ETF as well. But can you talk a little bit more about the impact of model portfolios on ETF flows? Because I'm not sure some people appreciate just how much models can drive flows. And I would say, to your point, that's only going to increase, right, as model portfolio usage grows. But I feel like pretty much any time you see an under-the-radar ETF take in significant flows, if you want to play Sherlock Holmes on what's happening, like you and I always like to do, I think model portfolio should always be at the top of the suspect list.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And you actually put it very well, right, that whenever there's a fund that may be newer or, a little under the radar, and it suddenly gets a big jump in flows, usually that the flow activity can be traced back to, the issuer or the fund company using it within their model portfolios, in some capacity, right? So I think immediately of, years and years ago, when J.P. Morgan first came to the table with ETFs, they had a couple of funds called the Beta Builders products, which are still in circulation today, and you can still go out and get them. They're out there. But these funds just zoomed past $1 billion in assets under management faster than almost any other fund we had seen up to that point. And the reason was because J.P. Morgan had been using these funds within their model portfolios. They had rotated out of some iShares products and so on, and then put their own money in. So that led to just an enormous accretion of flows very quickly. And so you're seeing that, I think, with any big asset manager that has the ability to offer model portfolios, whether it's State Street or BlackRock or J.P. Morgan or whomever. This is primarily what I think they may be using ETFs for, is to stuff their own model portfolios. I mean, it's great that everybody can access these funds, and they're certainly not going to turn that away, of course. But when they're thinking about ETF creation, I think a good chunk of that thought process goes, how can we use this to great effect in our model portfolio allocation?
Yeah, and this probably goes without saying, but most of the largest ETF issuers with some of the most popular ETFs also have the largest footprint in the model portfolio world. And so this just feeds on itself. And again, I think we're going to continue to see model portfolios as a real distribution channel that is going to continue to grow. So I think we'll continue to have these types of flow stories. Okay, what else has caught your attention on the equity ETF side?
So one thing that's definitely caught my attention is in regards to small caps, right? So everybody's talking about the Magnificent Seven and concentration risk in the U.S. markets, and we're seeing that have a real impact on the flows that are going into ETFs that hold U.S. companies farther down on that size spectrum. So we've seen a lot of flows going into small cap stocks like Vanguard Small Cap ETF, ticker VB, that's brought in over $4 billion in new net money in 2024. IJR, that's iShares, a small cap fund, that's brought in almost $2 billion. Small cap growth from Vanguard, VBK, that's brought in over $1 billion. Avantis' small cap value ETF, that's benefited. So lots of flows in small cap land, right? But we're also seeing some money move into mid caps as well. So the iShares mid cap ETF, ticker IJH, that's brought in $3.4 billion. The mid-cap ETF from Vanguard, VO, that's brought in almost $2 billion. So as long as the S&P is going to, and just, I guess, the U.S. market in general, remains so top-heavy, I think you're going to continue to see money going into these small, mid spaces just as a sort of protection mechanism, because if Apple so much as sneezes, billions in market cap get wiped out. So you have to think beyond just those top-heavy stocks, and we're really seeing investors explore their options in this regard.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think that this will continue to be a flow story moving forward. You said it well. I think investors are hoping that small caps in particular, certainly mid caps as well, but I think more on the small cap side, that they're going to sort of play catch up to large caps after these years of underperformance. So I just looked at the numbers. If you look at VB, that Vanguard small cap ETF, versus the S&P 500, so VU, the Vanguard S&P 500 ETF, VU has outperformed VB by over 30% over the past 3 years. So it's about 37% total return for VU to 6% for VB. And if you look at valuations right now, and again, valuations are not great short-term market, you know, timing mechanisms. They tend to work well over the longer term, but small caps do look much more attractive. And so I think what we're seeing here with some of the flows into small cap ETFs are investors clearly trying to play that. And again, I think we'll continue to see that. By the way, on CAF, the Pacer U.S. Small Cap Cash Cows 100 ETF, has any issuer had more under the radar success than Pacer? It's amazing. You look at cows, I think that's taken in like $1.5-2 billion this year. That's their U.S. Cash Cows 100 ETF. I think that's in the top, say, 35 to 40 of all ETFs in terms of inflows. You look at CAF, which is in the top 25 of inflows. These products are truly resonating, and it goes back over the past couple of years, especially last year. And you look at Pacer overall, I think they have something like over $4 billion in inflows so far this year, and they're up to like 14th on the ETF leaderboard. It's pretty impressive.
It really is. They're this quiet, under-the-radar success story, and it's been that way for a few years, as you said. And I think it's because the Cash Cow series is capturing something that investors are starting to wake up to, which is this concept that high free cash flow yield can be an indication of quality within a company, right? So Victory Shares has a fund with a Vettify index also tracking free cash flow yield too, that's ticker FLO, but the Cash Cows ETF came first. And what makes this series what it is that it's looking for companies that have a high cash flow after paying expenses, paying interest, paying taxes. And if they still have a high cash flow, that means they're more likely to survive tough economic periods, and then they're going to reinvest that free cash that they have just lying around into growth for the business or for more dividends for their shareholders. So free cash flow yield, which is free cash flow divided by enterprise value, that's proven to be an indicator that really shows off a good company, a good quality company. So I think they've landed Pacer on a very compelling idea here. Cows and calves have seen billions and billions in net flows over the past 3 years. I'm seeing $30 billion over the past 3 years,
wow,
which is just a remarkable success story.
Yeah, and I think particularly in the small cap space, I've talked about this before. I know a lot of investors and advisors have concerns around so-called zombie companies, right? These companies that can't service their debt. We've had rates jump over the past couple of years, or they're not making any money. And so a product like CAF is a way to approach that small cap space and do it to what you said, with more of a quality tilt. So this is another area I think we're going to continue to see some growth in. All right, briefly here before we move on, anything else on the equity ETF side you would touch on?
Well, I think there's a lot of interest starting to swell just over the last couple of months and years around income products, but the flavor that interest is taking is shifting a little bit. So we're seeing investors increasingly looking at multi-sector diversified income approaches. So things like BINC and JEPQ and JEPI, right? Not just a single income source or a single type of options, but kind of a portfolio approach with many options or many securities that lend towards income generation, which is, you know, also actively managed income generating products seems to be sort of having a moment. One thing that I also should point out is that we're seeing increased flows into dividend ETFs this year. So I saw the Schwab dividend ETF, SCHD, which I feel like in 2022, you and I were talking about this fund every single time I came on, because it just was hoovering up money over the course of the year. Well, that's starting to get a lot of money again. It brought in about $11 billion year to date, so one of the highest flows getters of the year. So, you know, dividends are back, income is back.
The one that stands out to me there when I was looking at the flow leaderboard is the one you touched on, BINC, which is the BlackRock Flexible Income ETF. Yeah, I'm sure you recall that's managed by Rick Rieder. It's pretty prominent in the space. That thing already has about $2.5 billion in less than a year. It launched last May, so that's clearly a success story. JEPQ, I guess the only thing that I would say on that, you may recall my 2024 ETF predictions. And one of those is that I still think this entire covered call ETF space is a bubble. I just think there have been way too many product launches here. But again, to your point, these things are getting flows. And we always say, money talks in the ETF space. It's a meritocracy. Investors are going to vote with their hard-earned dollars, and clearly investors are still interested here. Now, I do think if the market continues to march upward, we might start seeing some outflows here, but maybe not. I've been surprised. And actually, I saw last week BlackRock launched two more of these things. They launched an S&P 500 buy right ETF and then a Russell 2000 buy right ETF. So I'm probably early in my call, assuming I'm right at all. But yeah, the income space is, again, that you look at the flow leaderboard, those things are all over it. Okay.
People can't get enough of them.
Yeah, it's amazing. Speaking of income, let's move on to the fixed income side. Any ETF standing out to you here? Not quite as exciting as the equity side, but what do you see?
Well, you say that, but I think fixed income is pretty, it has its moments and pockets of interest, right? So there's been a lot of talk about how the Fed is going to cut rates. It's not a matter of if anymore, but when, and we're just trying to figure out when that's going to be. So what I think is interesting, though, is that I'm noticing that the flows aren't necessarily indicating that investors think rates are going to be cut anytime soon, right? So the most popular bond ETF so far this year, you mentioned it up at the top, Vanguard's Intermediate Term Treasury Index ETF, ticker VGIT, that's brought in $4.4 billion in new net flows. The long-term version of the fund, VGLT, that's brought in about $2 billion. We're seeing intermediate corporates also getting some flows. So intermediate term and longer-term fixed income is what is attracting the money rather than the shortest end of the curve, which we saw, you know, last year where everybody was piling into those 0 to 3 or, you know, 1 year maturity sort of products, right? The most popular short-term bond ETF this year, S-Gov, that's only brought in about $2 billion in comparison. So I think investors are looking at hot inflation reports. They're looking at these job numbers. They're thinking to themselves, am I really going to be cutting rates this year? Am I sure that that's really going to happen? So yields are still pretty high when you look farther out the curve. And I think investors are still doing a fair bit of yield chasing right now, pertinent to the discussion we just had, right? I don't think they're acting like rates are about to fall tomorrow, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I've, again, this is another topic I've talked about. I think advisors and investors are sort of trying to straddle the middle, and that's why that intermediate part of the curve looks more attractive. You know, if the Fed does drop rates, maybe they don't want to be on the front end. They want to lock in a little bit of yield. But that said, if we keep getting some hot inflation data and, you know, the economy keeps humming along, I don't know that you want to be on the long end either. I still don't really
feel great about the risk. They're going to get burned, but right. I think you cannot discount the profound effect of yield chasing in the bond ETF space.
On the fixed income side, one thing I did want to ask you about, I saw a press release last week from FM on their single treasury bond ETF lineup. So they have that U.S. Treasury three-month bill ETF, T-bill. That thing just crossed $3 billion in assets. And if you look at their lineup overall, it's approaching $4.5 billion in assets. I'm curious, any thoughts on why those have been such a hit? And I would say, look, I mean, FM clearly had great timing in terms of launching this lineup in 2022, right, with interest rates increasing. And so I think investors were looking to take advantage of those higher yields. They also wanted to control for rate risk, as we were just alluding to. But do you think it's that simple, just that they had perfect timing and then that momentum has sort of carried over? Do you think there's more to it?
I think that's part of it. I remember when these products launched, it was right around when the single stock ETF launched. And I admit, I sort of assumed that the motivations for launching them were the same as, you know, launching a single stock ETF. But I don't think that's truly the case, right? These single treasury ETFs, they serve kind of a different function. Investors, I think, they've proven that they want more targeted exposure to very narrow or particular niches of the fixed income market, like single treasury exposure. Yet the fixed income market being what it is, it's really difficult to do that, except in a vehicle like an ETF, right? Are you going to go out and buy individual T-bills for your clients and then rebalance your portfolio every few months to keep it, you know, that exposure consistent? And it's just pain, right? When you can just buy a single treasury ETF that does the hard work for you. So I think that we're seeing, this is emblematic or symptomatic of, the interesting success stories that we're seeing in the fixed income market are stories like this, where the ETF vehicle is packaging a fixed income exposure that is very difficult to get outside of that vehicle, like a single treasury exposure, like CLOs, like, you know, sector-based a fixed income approach. The fixed income market is so opaque, and it's over-the-counter trading and really weird pricing, and not everybody feels comfortable doing that. So having that vehicle of the ETF is really broadening out and delivering on that promise of democratizing access that ETFs have always been held up as being the, you know, that's their superpower, right? So it's kind of cool to see.
Yeah. I mean, it comes down to convenience. We talk about it all the time. The ETF wrapper is making it very convenient for investors, in this case, to access these on-the-run treasuries. And FM has clearly found something here. I love seeing success stories like this, because I do think when they first launched, there was some skepticism here. But again, $4.5 billion later, as we said, investors vote with their dollars. And they're clearly doing so here. And I think to what you were saying, it just speaks to the innovation in ETFs. And it speaks to the fact that even though this industry is 30 plus years old, there are still areas of opportunity. There's still white space. All right, only a few minutes left. With our remaining time, I want to get into one of your favorite categories, which is alternative assets. And we're going to take this in pieces, so I think you know what one of them is going to be. But the first one I want to ask you about is physical gold ETFs. And again, I was looking this morning, Laura. It's amazing. Right now, you have gold prices near record highs. But if you look at physical gold ETFs, I show about $4 billion in outflows. And that's after significant outflows last year. And so I'm curious what you think is going on here. I mean, I feel like this has been one of the more dumbfounding ETF flow stories I've seen in a while. Really, again, going back the past several years.
Yeah, I love this story because it's really, it's a psychology experiment in action. So you mentioned $4 billion, but that's just the U.S. market. If you factor in European funds as well, you're looking at nearly $6 billion in outflows from 2024 alone just in the last 3 months. And a lot of that negative sentiment has to do with, this consensus or increase in consensus around an impending rate cut. Gold tends to do its best when it can kind of show off its worth as a store of value against the dollar. But, you know, we've had a strong dollar. We've had strength in the equities markets and strength in the labor markets and so on and so forth. So in a strong economy, gold doesn't look as appealing as a store of value. Because what I think, you know, we have to remember is that gold ETF flows are often an indicator of sentiment within the investor class on the investment case for holding gold. They're not always going to match up with the real world demand from central banks or from people who want to hold gold jewelry. And we're seeing that disconnect in action right now, right? So central bank buying, central banks have just been hoovering up gold 2 years in a row of record high buying. It is now over worldwide. We're looking at over 1 trillion ounces in reserves for the past 2 years. So a lot of that's being driven by store of value demand in China and in Poland. But on top of that, you have very steady jewelry demand, not dipping at all despite the high prices. So you have this curious picture where the demand for gold is high, but investors in the U.S. are feeling more optimistic. So gold ETFs have seen outflows even as prices and demand keep going up and up.
I hear what you're saying about gold ETFs just being a small sliver of the overall gold market. I think that goes without saying. But I guess what has surprised me is that if you look at performance, even though gold hasn't kept pace with the S&P 500, it hasn't been horrible either. So I show, like, if you look at GLD, that's up 23% over the past 3 years. That's compared to 37% on the S&P 500. That's not bad. And if you look at GLD compared to other asset classes, it's pretty good. And I remember talking about this last year, like if you go back to 2022, which we know was a really rough year in the equity markets, you know, gold held up relatively well. And I'm just surprised from a diversification standpoint, more ETF investors aren't looking here, which I guess gets into our last topic, which is spot Bitcoin ETFs. I know you've just been salivating to talk about this, and you know, perhaps Bitcoin ETFs are stealing some demand now from gold ETFs. I don't know about that, but by the way, let me ask you this. Are you ready to concede on our dinner bet yet? Which was that spot Bitcoin ETFs would what? Take in more than $10 billion over the first 12 months, right? That was the bet?
I think I was ready to concede after the first 47 minutes of trading, right? I made this prediction at the start of the year that, you know, interest in Bitcoin had faded and we weren't going to see a lot of net money coming in. It was just going to be seed capital and money was going to come out of GBTC and into the other products, which we have seen that. I will stick up for past Laura on that point. We have seen a lot of money coming out of GBTC. But broadly speaking, I was so wrong on this. And, you know, just the top two largest ETFs, iShares and Fidelity, we mentioned up at the top, they brought in over $20 billion, I think, in assets last I checked. And that's okay. I knew I was either going to be very right or very wrong on this, and it's okay to be proven wrong about things. I suppose I was a little shocked to see just how much money has gone in, not necessarily in the first few weeks, because I think we kind of all expected that there would be some hot money coming off the out of other products and going into the ETF. But just the sheer continued and sustained enthusiasm for these products has really surprised me. Money is still pouring into these products. There's no slowing down. And I think what's exciting to me about that is, you know, we can dig into the numbers and, about this Bitcoin ETF and that Bitcoin ETF and whatever. But what I think is really cool is to see how engaged a whole new population of investors has become about the inner mechanics and workings of ETFs. I've had more in-depth conversations about cash creations and ETF liquidity in the past 3 months than I've had in the past maybe 15 years prior, right? So as an ETF nerd, that's really thrilling to me. It seems like there's an education that's happening in real time. And so maybe the Bitcoin ETF could be a gateway towards greater investor understanding in the ETF vehicle and in investing as a whole. Or at least that's my hope, you know?
I love that. I think you're 100% right. I've been amazed just covering this over the past couple of years, how interested people are in, say, the regulatory process. What's an S-1? What's a 19b-4 filing? And then getting into the mechanics of ETFs. What are cash creations and redemptions? How does that compare to in-kind? You know I love that. I think it's great that this has given us an opportunity to educate broader investors on ETF mechanics. And also, I'll tell you, Laura, just my interactions with the crypto crowd in general, you know, I know some people want to paint them as just a price goes up, you know, to the moon type crowd. Some of the most thoughtful, you know, smartest people I've interacted with that truly care about understanding economics and monetary policies and the mechanics of ETFs. And so it's just such an interesting, you know, dynamic there. And, you know, going back to the flows, so just to put a few numbers around this, I show about $12 billion net have gone into the 10-spot Bitcoin ETF. So that's about $24 billion into the 9 new ETFs, and then roughly $12 billion out of GBTC. No matter how you slice that, I think just a remarkable success story thus far. About a minute left. I'm assuming you think this will continue in terms of demand?
I absolutely think it's going to continue. And I think we're going to see it continue, driven just to circle back up to the top of what we were talking about with model allocations. I was checking some things. BlackRock, for example, their mutual funds in the global allocation space, they now have approval to hold spot Bitcoin ETFs instead of Bitcoin futures ETFs. And so if they're moving from those futures exposures or futures ETF exposures into spot Bitcoin ETFs, that would, you know, move hundreds of you know, it would move a lot of money, right? So I think if you have multiple versions of mutual funds across multiple issuers using spot Bitcoin ETFs inside these model portfolio and mutual fund and other allocation opportunities, that's really going to move the needle, and that's, I think, likely what we're seeing right now.
Well, and to add to that, there's a number of large investment advisory or brokerage platforms that still haven't even approved these things, which is remarkable. That can be another gateway. It's just so interesting. Bitcoin is such a polarizing topic, right? Some people think this is the future of money or store value. Other people think it's complete vaporware. I don't think that part of the story is going to change anytime soon. But Laura, we're going to have to leave it there. Great stuff as always. It's just so much fun going through these flows. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Laura Krieger, Editor-in-Chief at Vettafi.
Growth and innovation, two words that best describe the ETF industry. However, rapid growth and innovation creates a critical need for financial advisors and industry practitioners' education. Enter the ETF Institute, the first and only independent organization providing industry professionals and financial advisors with certification, education, and training on ETFs. Learn more about the Certified ETF Advisor designation by visiting cetf.org.
I'm now joined by Rob Harvey, co-head of product specialist at Dimensional, who currently offers 38 ETFs with $130 billion in assets. That's been done in about 3.5 years. They didn't launch their first ETF until November of 2020. And of course, Dimensional takes a systematic, active approach to investing and their ETF lineup overall, which will be the focus of my conversation with Rob, who is now on the line with me from Austin. Rob, great to connect and welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
All right, so let's start with that growth of the Dimensional ETF lineup. As I mentioned, you have gone from literally $0 in ETF assets to now $130 billion in about 3.5 years. That is across 38 ETFs. I show you're now the 8th largest ETF issuer. And, you know, look, high level, obviously, that includes some mutual fund ETF conversions. And I'm sure some prior Dimensional investors have also simply switched from the mutual fund to ETF wrapper. But no matter how you slice this, it's been a highly impressive last few years. And, you know, even so far this year, I show nearly $8 billion in net inflows. And so to start, just talk about the overall growth of the lineup and perhaps what stood out to you in terms of investor interest.
Yeah, well, you're so right. You hit on a lot of the important points that we like to reiterate it as well, which is this has grown from nothing. We weren't in the space in 2019. And so to have $130 billion now be the single largest active ETF issuer in the market, that's pretty impressive. And, you know, you also mentioned that the product suite has grown to 38 ETFs. We expect that product suite to grow over time. I think one of the things that's really impressive when you look at the AUM numbers is it's not just a handful of funds that are carrying it. We've actually seen positive flows for every fund in the product suite, not just since inception, but over the last year as well. So you mentioned, you know, we've had good flows to start the year off with so far. That's really been something that we've seen not just in a couple of products, but across the lineup. So that's been great to see as well. You know, the interest that we have in the lineup and the products in general kind of comes from a couple different places. You have your DFA diehards, if you will, who were invested with the mutual funds. They know us. They love us. They were excited about the conversions. They moved, you know, some of their assets when we launched these ETFs. And those are a lot of the people that you see in sort of our more traditional flagship products like DFSV, for example, U.S. Small Cap Value. But you also mentioned, you know, we were able to access financial professionals that we really couldn't talk to before because they were using ETFs exclusively. And we work with close to 40% more financial professionals now than we did 4 or 5 years ago because of the ETFs. And that investor base has different preferences. They have different beliefs. And so what we've seen in the ETFs is we've been able to launch new strategies that are so consistent with our investment philosophy, but really are better tailored to some of the new investors we have. So, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about indexing today. One of the things that we hear from these new investors is they want beta and they want it at a reasonable price. And so they turn to us and say, you know, we like some of the things about indexing, low cost, well diversified, but we want to be able to do it in a better way. Can you help us? And that is really Dimensional's bread and butter. So in our core equity market solutions, for example, only available in ETFs, we've seen a tremendous amount of growth there. They're already over $15 billion. And obviously all of that is new because they didn't exist prior to 2019. And that's been great to see as well.
Well, I think no matter how you slice it, clearly your approach is resonating. And you mentioned just high level your investment approach. You know, it's interesting, Rob, because while Dimensional's ETFs are technically active, it's not the traditional stock picking active management that some people might envision when they hear the word active, right? It's a systematic approach. And that is actually where I thought it might be helpful to spend our time today, because at a very high level, I would say investors have three options. There's traditional stock picking active, there's systematic active, which is what you do, and then there's traditional passive or index-based funds. And I want to compare systematic active versus indexing because I do think this sometimes causes confusion among investors and advisors, at least in my experience. But first, for people unfamiliar, do you want to just explain what systematic active means? And you know, maybe how that compares to traditional stock picking active management, and then we can get into the indexing comparisons.
Yeah, that's great. And I think, you know, I love the fact that you have sort of three boxes that you're putting out there, the traditional active, systematic active, and then you have maybe sort of your passive or indexing. A lot of times when we talk to investors, they've got two boxes in front of them, and it's, are you active or are you passive? And that conversation is interesting because we're kind of both and we're kind of neither. So I don't think it's unhelpful to view things in that context, but I do think it kind of needs some explaining. So what do we mean when we say that we're both and neither? Well, when you think about what are the benefits of indexing, as I said, a lot of it that is attractive to investors is you have broad market diversification and you have low costs. Our founders actually came from working on some of the first index funds all the way back in 1981. And there was a lot of things that they liked about index funds, namely those two things, right? You like this idea of cheap beta, essentially, is attractive. It makes up the core of a lot of investors' portfolios. But there's a couple problems with indexing as well. Namely, number one, you can't utilize the academic research out there. So if you have, you know, the greatest minds in modern financial theory that you've worked with throughout your schoolwork and your professional career, like Eugene Fama, Ken French, you know, Bob Merton, Myron Scholes, none of that's being utilized in an index. So you're kind of leaving money on the table in that sense. And the other issue is with implementation. You can kind of think about it conceptually. Does it make sense to tell the market what you're going to do before you do it? No, of course not. No one in the active space would ever do that, right? Again, you're letting people walk away with money. You're leaving money on the table. So there are issues there, and that's kind of how we differentiate ourselves from indexing, although we're oftentimes confused with indexing because of our low fees. But then you kind of look on the other side of the table, and you've got traditional active. And when we talk about the fact that we're the largest active ETF issuer, I think a lot of people have the idea that we've got highly concentrated portfolios, you know, 30 names, we're reading the tarot cards and the tea leaves, trying to figure out whether or not we like Bank of America better than Citigroup because, you know, something that the CEO said or something like that. You know, that's what you think about with stock pickers. That's traditional active management. And we're nothing like that because it tends to be high fees and high conviction or high concentration. But the goal of active management is to outperform the market. They want to outperform their benchmarks. Now, they're pretty miserable at achieving that. The track record isn't great for survivorship or outperformance. But that goal is something that we have as well. We don't want to just perform as well as an index. We know we can do better. And the track record shows that we have. So when you compare us, again, you've got sort of similarities between both, but we like to think that we're really offering the best of both approaches.
I think that was an excellent description. And again, you know, my sense is I do think many investors can get their head around traditional stock picking versus systematic active. But going back to your description of say, systematic active versus indexing, I do think it can cause some confusion. And I want to spend more time there because I want to try to make it crystal clear for investors the differences here and really highlight the pros and cons of each. And on the indexing side, maybe this goes without saying, but any index is a human construct, right? This isn't some sort of methodology ordained by the investment gods or something like that, right? I just think it's interesting because you can look at, say, five different index-based small-cap ETFs. And you know this, you're going to find some real differences in terms of construction. It's not as easy as an investor saying, you know, look, I'm going to index my small-cap allocation and voila, I magically capture everything that asset class has to offer. And so I'd love to have you maybe talk more of that because I just think it gets us in to really helping understand why Dimensional takes the approach it does.
Yeah, it's great. And first of all, I'm definitely using that line about not created by the investment gods because I really think that a lot of investors kind of tend to think of that way. The index is the market, right? And that's just not true. First of all, we have to acknowledge that indices have a lot of different perspectives on what, quote unquote, the market is. So a lot of people, if you ask them and say, well, how many indices do you think they are? They'll, you know, everybody will be able to name, you know, a couple to maybe a couple dozen, and they'll assume that they're going to miss some. So you kind of get estimates and maybe the hundreds or the low thousands. There's 3 million indices that are out there. And anytime that you have 3 million different perspectives on what the market is, you know that there are decisions that are being made there. And reasonably, investors might say, okay, yeah, well, listen, there might be 3 million indices, but how different do they look relative to one another? Does it matter, in other words? Does the choice really impact my investment experience? And you pointed out something that I think is really helpful, which is look at a couple of indices in a particular area of the market and see what the performance looks like relative to one another. And that unveils a lot about not only how differently they're constructed, but also how different the investment experience is. So you brought up U.S. small caps, and I think this is a great example. You look at the S&P 600, the Russell 2000, and the CRSP U.S. small cap index going back 20 years. On average, the difference between the top performing index and the bottom performing index in a given calendar year is over 5%. And when you think about how different that looks, you know, 5% difference, you could be talking about equities and fixed income in a given year. And here what you're talking about is the same exact asset class on the surface, U.S. small caps, and your average difference is 5%. I mean, that is mind-boggling to think about. And that's the average, right? Some years it's going to be lower. Some years it'll be, you know, 2%. Some years it'll be 12%. And so it's really difficult, I think, when you look at those results to say, oh, well, the index is just the market, because it really isn't. And it makes a big difference about what index you choose. And as I said before, it also starts to pull back the curtain a little bit and raise some questions about, well, if the results are so different, why? What are the decisions that are being made? Because clearly it's not as passive as a lot of investors might think.
Well, talk a little bit about some of those decisions that are being made, because as you go through that, a natural conclusion, at least for me, is that indexing is ultimately active in the sense that there are these active decisions being made in terms of the index methodology. And actually, in the case of some indices like the S&P 500, there's literally a committee deciding what to own. And I know they have rules and constraints, but there are true active decisions being made. So how do you think about those choices around index construction?
Yeah, it's a good point. And I love that you brought up the S&P index committee as well. I think that surprises a lot of people, because a lot of people think, well, an index is kind of just a book of rules. And by and large, that is mostly true. But as you brought up earlier, the book of rules that was created by investors. It was created by humans. There's bias in that. And then, of course, when you add an index committee on top of that, there's even more decisions. So let's talk about a couple examples of this. Let's talk about the Russell, first of all, which is a rule book. There isn't like an index committee that has like, you know, overriding power to decide when stocks get added and which ones and what have you, like the S&P. So maybe the Russell represents more of a sort of a pure market exposure in some people's mind, because you're removing some of that bias. Well, think about what the impact of some of those rules is. So the Russell, for example, has decided that reconstitution in the index will only happen once a year. So what does it mean when you say that you should only revisit your holdings once a year? You're making a call that says, well, the market's not going to move that much in 12 months, so you don't really have to look at your holdings more than once a year. That is a very active decision that you've just made, and one that we know, even over the last couple of years, has proven to be completely wrong. I mean, think about what the last 12 months have held and how differently things look. Would you want your portfolio to have changed with that information? Do you want to adapt and incorporate that information, or you just find riding it out and just, you know, third Friday in June is when you look at your holdings once again? So clearly that is an example of something that not only is a decision, but really impacts what your investment experience can be like, particularly if you're invested in sort of a factor-based strategy. You know, you want to pursue small cap value names, for example, Russell 2000 value versus a DFSV, as I mentioned before. You know, what's small value today doesn't stay small value tomorrow or in the future. And there's lots of examples of that. One of my favorite ones to talk about is GameStop, right? When we saw GameStop explode from this tiny little small cap value name all the way up to be bigger than 40% of S&P 500 constituents, what would you want your small cap value manager to do? Would you want them to revisit that holding and exit the position and reinvest in small value? Or would you want them to hold it for another 6 months? And that's the difference between the Russell and, you know, a dimensional portfolio. We sold in January at $350 a share. And if you were in the Russell, you held it and wrote it all the way back down, pretty much. So that is a good example of a rule book. Now, you mentioned before the index committee, and I think that's fascinating as well. because, as you said, the S&P has a methodology book, like guidelines that they have about, you know, what they're going to be doing and sort of minimum criteria. But the index committee is really the one who makes the decisions about what's happening. And I think two things that are shocking for investors about this. Number one, we have no idea who's on the index committee. It's not public information. So it's anybody's guess as to the qualifications and the thought process of what goes into these decisions that are being made. So if you have questions about why the S&P did something, good luck finding answers, right? You're just going to have to speculate. And the second thing is, the index committee oftentimes makes decisions that are a lot more active than people might expect from an index. So one of my favorite examples I like to talk about is back in 2005, you know, Google had its IPO, was large enough to be included in the S&P 500 index, but it wasn't. And the chairman of the index committee actually came out and explained why Google wasn't part of the S&P 500 yet. And he said, well, it's just done so well. It's done so well that surely what goes up must come down. So here you have what's perceived to be a very, you know, unbiased, unemotional, unimpacted by human, intervention type of a index. And they're doing technical analysis on their holdings. And by the way, if you go back and look at 2005, like pull up a price chart on your computer about what happened with Google, you know, since 2005, that downturn that they were expecting never came, right? It's essentially just a straight shot up, not even straight. It's exponential if you look at it on the graphic. So, you know, not only are they making active decisions, but as you'd expect from someone who's making a lot of active decisions, a lot of them are wrong. So I think investors have to be able to look at that and say, am I comfortable with this rule book? Why was it created the way it was? And am I comfortable in an index committee making decisions when I don't know who they are and I don't know what decisions they've made, but based on what they've done in the past, it doesn't always turn out well.
Rob, you mentioned the word bias earlier. And as you may or may not know, I like to occasionally play devil's advocate on ETF Prime. So I'm going to try to do that now. And the question that I have is, you mentioned rule book. And so once these index rules and constraints are set, and let's set aside an index committee, you know, sort of arbitrarily making some of these active decisions. Let's just say we have an index rule book. There is some rigidity in that, and that the index and ultimately an ETF that tracks it is simply going to follow those rules. And I would say from my perspective, that's what many investors view as a positive of indexing, in that it removes any human emotion in bias, at least mm-hmm. after the rules are set, right? Because we know how mm-hmm. detrimental human emotion and bias can be in investing. And you had a great example with GameStop. But, mm-hmm. you know, some people may say, well, that's an extreme example. And there's plenty of examples that may go the other way. So I guess my question is, do you agree that that rigidity can be a positive, at least when it comes to, you know, eliminating some of that human emotion and bias?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's two ways that you can kind of approach the concept of the rigidity in an index, which is, you know, number one, do you agree with the way that the rules have been set? So, yes, the rules are rigid. Are those rules that you want to abide by in your portfolio? And then two is flexibility to deviate from those rules based on what you're seeing in the market important to you? So, you know, when you think about sort of the rules that you have about, you know, for example, what's small cap, what's value, you know, what's in your investment universe, you have to be able to sign off and say, yes, I think that, you know, the three metrics that Russell uses to evaluate value stocks are better than the eight metrics that MSCI uses. And I'm comfortable with that decision. And if the research evolves over time, and you learn more about where expected returns are coming from, which we know is always happening in the academic community, maybe you don't get to incorporate that information, right? Maybe that's something that you can't take advantage of because your index has its rules and they want to follow them, right? So that's number one is, do you agree with the rules? And I would say one of the things that you can think about with as an investor is, who made the rules? Where did they come from? You know, are the rules being constructed in accordance with the greatest minds in modern financial theory? Or is it just kind of a finger in the wind and said, you know what, the third Friday in June just seems like a good day to do rebalancing, right? So that's one thing. But the thing is about flexibility. And one thing when you see particularly in, you know, volatile markets, like we had, for example, in March of 2020, or you have in major market events like, you know, Russia or some of the sanctions that we've seen on Chinese securities, is do you want to be nimble and move quickly when information comes out in the market? So, for example, you know, the example I gave before, so those Chinese securities that were being sanctioned, we all knew that U.S. investors were going to have to divest themselves from those securities. So it's not a secret. Everybody holds them, and you're going to have to not hold them. If you are in an index fund, you're going to sell it at the same time every other index fund investor is going to sell it. And so that's going to create a lot of price pressure. You don't have flexibility around that information, even though you know it's going to happen. But if you're a different kind of asset manager that isn't as concerned with tracking error, then you can sell it in advance and you don't have to wait to have the same experience that everybody else has. And so, you know, in every aspect of our life, we know that flexibility is important. My chiropractor tells me that all the time. Right? That's why we, you know, try to get up and move from our desks every 15 minutes, every hour, whatever it is. But for some reason in our investments, the flexibility starts to become viewed as, you know, something that's bad. And I'm not saying that you should have unlimited discretion in a portfolio. It should be very clear about what your goals are and how you accomplish them. But, man, I'll tell you, especially when things are volatile and the market's going one way, flexibility is incredibly important and really can make the difference in your investment experience.
Rob, just a few minutes left here. I want to try to tie this all together and talk about how investors might actually use dimensionals ETFs. And I think as we've driven home here today, every investment decision is ultimately active, right? And so, again, if I just play devil's advocate and I think about dimensionals approach, isn't it a pretty active decision to tilt towards, say, small caps and profitability and value and some of the other factors dimensional prioritizes? Like, how does an investor know that's potentially a better path longer term? Because some of these factors have had significant underperformance over the past 10 or 15 years. So how should investors think about making those active tilts? I get everything you're saying in terms of the flexibility dimensional has, but how should investors think about that?
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think we have to acknowledge right off the bat that there really isn't such a thing as an absence of decision making. If you're with dimensional, if you're with an index, if you decide to stick your cash under your mattress and not be in the market, all of those are decisions. I think what's helpful or more helpful in terms of framework is, what are you basing your decisions off of? Do you feel good about those decisions and what's informed them? And, you know, when you pick up, you know, a financial analyst journal or any kind of new research that's highlighting some of the things that's being thought about or proposed in academia, no one can propose anything with any level of, you know, being taken seriously by their peers without regressing their research against exactly what we have incorporated in our strategies. If you don't run your analysis against the FAMA French three-factor model, you're going to get laughed out of the room because people are going to say, well, how do you know that's not just a size and value factor loading that's essentially explaining these returns that you're talking about? So I think that best-in-class research is incredibly important. And we also have to acknowledge exactly what you said. It's been challenging in the U.S. over shorter periods of time. That's definitely true. We've seen that in the past as well. You know, when we launched in 1981 as a microcap strategy was our first mutual fund, and microcaps didn't do well for the first few years that we were in business. But it's very intuitive that microcaps should do well, and they have, you know, since, and the long-term performance has been good. We also have to look outside the U.S. You know, I think as U.S. investors, we think the U.S. is the whole world, and whatever we're doing is what everybody else is doing. The premiums are working phenomenally well in developed ex-U.S. markets and emerging markets as well. They've also worked really well over in the U.S. over longer time periods. You are in sort of a strange environment where right now, if your portfolio wasn't nothing but NVIDIA over the last year, then you didn't do as well as you could have. And, you know, will that be something that continues into the future? Are people comfortable buying companies that are trading at, you know, 33 times earnings? that's a question that you have to ask yourself and sort of stand back and say, does that make sense? Or is there a better way to think about what the future could hold and be happy with the gains that you've, you know, taken from some of those investments up until this point? So, you know, I think Dimensional's portfolios really serve a couple of different key areas in investors' portfolios. It can be the core, right, through our core equity market solutions. You want market-wide exposure. You want good implementation. You want some of that leading research from academia. That's great. It can also be used as a complement and say, hey, I really like the S&P 500. I just don't want to have my whole portfolio, you know, in the Mag 7, basically. And then you say, well, maybe I should add some small value or some targeted value in there to sort of balance things out a little bit. So we see investors do both. We're not here to say what's right or what's better. We're here to make the best investment products that we can and empower investor choice, ultimately.
Well, Rob, with that, we're going to have to leave it there. Just an excellent conversation this week. I just find this to be such an interesting topic, and I really appreciate you diving in here. I think this is really helpful to investors as they think through really those three broader buckets we talked about earlier. But thank you for joining me this week.
Of course. Thank you so much for the opportunity coming on the show. We really enjoyed it.
That was Rob Harvey, co-head of product specialist at Dimensional. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. Next week, I'll be joined by Andrew Maddock, portfolio manager at Matthews Asia. So we're going to discuss their actively managed approach to emerging markets. So they now have 12 ETFs spanning that broad category. So we'll look at several of those ETFs and really discuss the investment case for emerging markets overall. Until then, have a great week, everyone.